This is the ACTINF podcast, where we provide short clips from the Active Inference Institute weekly live streams. If you want to hear more of this material, check out the entire live stream at the Active Inference Institute YouTube channel. The link to the live stream is provided in the episode description. I am the host and curator of this episode. My name is Blue Knight, and this episode is going to be clipped from live stream number 11.2. Our discussion is based on the 2020 paper entitled Sophisticated Active Inference: Simulating Anticipatory Affective Dynamics of Imagining Future Events by Casper Hesp, Alex Shantz, Baron Millage, Maxwell Ramstad, Carl Friston, and Ryan Smith. This discussion is going to be facilitated by Daniel Friedman, who's going to start us off.
This is the affective inference question, where the affect of the agent is relating into how it simulates rolling out all these future time points. And at each time point in this model, the agent is going to be running out some possibilities for what could happen in the future. So Stephen, and then we'll think about the examples.
I am Stephen Sinnott. I'm in Toronto. And well, one thing that's come up, and I've been doing some work with this metaphors of movement, and Andrew Austin, who does that work, he talks a lot about how anxiety, he finds anxiety is often related to people trying to have elevated status, like they're trying to have an elevated status. And it makes a lot of sense with this, because it could also be like you feel like you put yourself in an elevated status and you're always going to be slightly uncertain, unless maybe you're a king or someone, about that status being maintained. So being put on a pedestal can be, so there could be something about Western society and status, which is partly why we have this overarching anxiety. Because, and it would make sense in a way, because there's always a sense of never being completely clear about whether your status is going to be maintained. So I thought that's kind of interesting. And this would sort of would support that kind of observation.
Yep. So status or various other sort of social approval metrics we can think of, it's like the water we swim in as social organisms. So just like a company might be wanting to stay above water financially, at least that department, a person has to be staying above water reputationally. We can think of it in that way. And so again, let's go to the examples and think about these different systems and what they might be performing inference on. Scott?
Hi, I'm Scott David. I'm at the University of Washington Applied Physics Lab, and I've been a lawyer for 27 years. I'm trying to use physics principles to help structure social relationships. I'm just going to comment on the status issue, that it feels like then you can adjust. So you're making serial adjustments, right? You're trying to minimize the free energy, minimize the difference between your expectation and the reality you're experiencing, as I understand it. So with that overall effective status, you can do what feels like compensating controls. So you could, if you feel like you're at risk vis-a-vis the one presentation you're making of self, you can rake in other presentations of self to complement or supplement or mitigate the impression of one of them, because you have myriad affective projections that you're making simultaneously. So it feels like if you have an awareness of this, it can help you with that presentation of self question by understanding that you, okay, this affective status that I'm presenting is not getting me where I want to be inside. So let me leverage another one, which is contiguous or a neighboring affectation. I'll call it an affectation here, but I mean in a presentation of a Markov binding site. So it feels like it gives a strategy for hybridizing and synthesizing your presentation of your Markov blankets. Anyway, keep going. Yes. It's impressional.
Yes. Okay. So let's go to the examples and think about how these three potentially even overlapping systems are going to be carrying this out. And an individual at each time point, maybe let's just say this is every second or each minute, a team might be interested in organizing on the multi-day, and the organization is going to be more explicitly thinking, okay, quarter to quarter, that's going to be our next time that we're going to do all this simulation. So it's not surprising that as things get bigger, they also get slower. So that's a common theme we're going to see. So the individual's affect is really where this emotional inspiration comes from. So there's the closest mapping between affect and emotion. But let's think about that team and the large company example. Well, affect again, and valence specifically, is like that plus to minus axis. So is this team going well? Is this company going well? And if someone says, yeah, we're burning money at an incredible rate, it's unsustainable, but it's going well because I have a believed trajectory that we're going to go on where we actually pull out of the nosedive and do XYZ. So they can still think it's going perfectly well, even if the instantaneous rate of loss is high. And then on the flip side, you can imagine a team or a large company where instantaneously their state looks like it's good. It looks like they have a lot of cash, or it looks like they have a lot of people involved in the team, but they still feel negative about it. So that disjoint between the affect about a situation and the state of the situation is one thing to take into account. Now let's connect the affect at all these levels to precision estimates at different levels. Especially in the active inference framework, which frames what organisms or any system is doing as precision seeking, high anxiety is going to be coming from having low precision. Now, it's not that we want zero uncertainty. We want to have this controlled novelty sort of U curve, but it can be clearly situations where your precision is too low, and then you're surprised by what is being emitted to you in the niche, whether it's your team operating environment or the company's operating environment. And then if your precision, it can't get too high, because if you're overly precise and you're incorrect, then you're gonna die. Like if you have a super, super accurate understanding, but you're just delusional, then you're going to fall off the cliff. So in a way, what shapes this precision is actually the real world, which prunes beliefs that are not functionally associated with success in the real world. Stephen, and then we'll come back to it.
Yeah, I really like this this idea of thinking about how we understand ourselves within all of this. So for instance, yeah, if you could move between a different regime of attention or sense of self, which could be like what happens when we do sense making, maybe even change the operating metaphors of the person, you know, who am I at the moment? You know, what's the context? What's my situational attunement? What's my team's purpose? What's the operating metaphor for this team? Are we like all driving together in a car, or are we building ourselves a fortress? You know, and that almost could give a way to jump in and out of these kind of affective engines, if that makes sense. So as you've seen over time, how's it going? What's the policy? And what's the affective states that are sort of thought about in a certain future? And they could almost then say, okay, well, what if I shifted? Maybe that's where you'd need the body, like the metaphor I'm working with. And then what does that do? And maybe at times that's when you need to work with a group to be able to do that, because maybe an individual can't just keep flipping backwards and forwards. You need to work as a group to do that kind of sense making across different times.
Cool. Scott?
I had a question for Sasha. You were mentioning pruning, but you weren't talking about dendritic pruning. But I wonder if dendritic pruning is describable by the type of pruning you were just talking about, because my understanding of dendritic pruning, very minimal, is that, you know, during the day you have the growth of dendrites and then there's pruned back selectively, and that is influenced by your externality. Each day the growth is influenced by your externality, and then there's this pruning process that feels like it's iterating itself at that level. Is that describable by this here? Is that another scale, or is it something else that's going on there?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting analogy. That's kind of what's happening there. I don't know if I would kind of draw all the same parallels. From a mechanistic standpoint, but it's true that kind of in the generalities that as connections are formed during the day, then they're pruned or lost as they're not used. And yet we think that happens at night. But yet I think that's an interesting analogy to draw, that it's beliefs about the world that aren't, useful or supported are the ones that then get pruned.
Yes.
I was also going to say the other aspect is, I think we know from our lived experience, is that it's really it's really interesting when people can be holding certain beliefs and not not know that. And then when they finally kind of confront the belief, it kind of, yeah, there's a bit of a breakdown. And to me, that moment is very interesting when people have to confront certain beliefs that maybe they didn't even recognize that they held.
So there's a phase change and a recontextualization piece. And the last part you said, Sasha, and the pruning is using a network analogy. So it's like pruning connections between different aspects of the system. And so let's think about the individual in the office having a conversation with somebody. The query, the prompt to them, let's just say, is, how are you feeling? And that is a query that's presented to the interface, which is their ears, and also their vision and other aspects. The query is presented to the interface about what's inside of the interface. And now what's happening inside of the interface is a generative model of that query presenting system. So inside of the person, there's a generative model of, for example, the person who's talking to them asking that question. And we know it's a generative model because if they covered up their eyes or if they only heard part of it, they might be able to still recover what was being asked. But in either case, there's a generative model inside of the interface, and a prompt is being presented as an observation, stimuli, to the interface that's querying how the system will respond. So speech is action, and that's not even a legal claim. It's that it's a motor claim. Speech is generated by a motor behavior. It's not your hand, but it is a motor behavior. And for some people, it is with their hand. So various body parts can be used to communicate. Let's think about that interface in the process of the team and the company. So potentially for these organizational entities, the interface could be like a consultant who interfaces with specific questions. But instead of a counselor who asks, how are you feeling, to an individual, there might be questions that could be asked to the team. And there could be questions that could be asked such that only the team could respond. And someone might say, well, how could you ask a question that only a team could respond to? Aren't teams composed of people? There's two things I'd say there. The first is that that's the reductionist argument. The reductionist slide is like, what do you mean get a response from a person? Aren't you just going to get a response from skin cells and neurons? It's like, right, that's what I'm trying to get, that response. So even if the response can be reductionistically understood as being composed of smaller pieces, that's not a surprise. That should be taken for default. So questions can be asked to teams that, of course, humans are going to be responding to as well. But also we can think about kind of like colony phenotypes. We can think about team phenotypes. So for example, let's just say I ask a question to a team, like, what did you have for lunch? Or what do you think the most exciting project is for next year? And then I looked at the distribution of how long it took people to respond to that message. That's like a colony level trait. It's a collective trait. That distribution is composed of people acting, but no individual can dictate what that distributional parameter is. So it's like a measurement of, let's just say, some blood cells. You flow a million blood cells through, and then you can get a distribution across all of those blood cells. So it's like you're querying in the aggregate, even though each individual subpiece could have been following that distribution or somewhat of an outlier. So those are the kinds of things that you could ask presenting to a team or an organization. And the team or the organization is going to have a generative model of its niche. So if it's involved in a certain type of consultancy where it paid a lot of money and it really respects what the person is going to be doing, then maybe when you ask them the question, what's the most exciting project and why, they give one response. Or what's the most challenging project of this year and why was it challenging? Whereas if you were in a different context, you'd give a different response because the generative model of the system across that interface is very different. So the response that it gives will be different, and it's going to be querying different things and externalizing different aspects of itself. Could be accurate, could be inaccurate. Scott?
So one of the things that raises is, I've been in some of the work that I've done in cybersecurity, I've been parsing principles versus ethics versus norms. And so it's kind of interesting, in querying a group, you're going to get an average, right? You'll get a Gaussian distribution or whatever of opinion, and you'll then it'll be informative. And so norms, I assert, for these purposes, that they're behaviors, behavioral expectations that are set through the past, what was normal. And one of the assertions I make is principles, and again, they're assertions, there's different overlap here. The principles are institutional assertions of aspiration. And ethics also are aspirational, but they're human assertions about human behaviors. That's the distinction I make, whatever words you want to use. And so it's interesting in the context of what you're talking about querying a group, because there's different evidentiary chunks that you'll look at, right? Normative, you'll be looking, according to those definitions, on, hey, what'd we do before? And what'd we do against the set of standards that set? The principles may be more aspirational, and it may be, you know, how are we doing towards that thing, but it's not necessarily based on what was done before. You can say our principles are more aspirational than what we did before. So it's interesting, just that interface of what's used in the discussion of the group dynamics and how that relates to what you were just describing, which is the querying of the group and individuals. The framing of the nature of that output you're getting from the group is kind of interesting based on that question asked, right? What do you do before is one question. What do you wish to do in the future is a different question.
Yes. So that query could be, what do you regularly do? So again, it could be the person in the office and someone says, what is your morning routine? That's something we talked about in a previous week. Or it could be a query to a team. What is your onboarding routine, or how do you welcome new members? And then this question of the aspirational and the norms. So it's funny because norms can mean what's normal. It means what's expected. That's what has happened in the past, because what's not normal, you know, if not the past, what's normal. But at the same time, normative means what should be. So a normative claim should be like, I think people should be treated this way. And that may or may not reflect what has been the norm. So people, all of belief systems make normative claims that sometimes are consistent with norms and sometimes are almost radically divergent from norms. Someone says the norm is A, but I think the norm should be B. So I'm making a normative claim about the norms and it should be different. And so these are all interesting things to, Scott?
So one big gap that's out there in the world right now is the gap between law and the interactions that technology allows. And I'm talking about fractally up and down the chain, reproductive interactions, biomedical, population-wide, all these different things. The law is really lagging, okay? So one of the things that's interesting about this, is there a possibility that this kind of analysis can help us to discover norms that would guide groups? And those norms, if they're sufficiently interesting to the groups, can be made enforceable into laws. And so that, to me, this is a very interesting way of a possibility of discovery of new laws and self-constraints that groups can put on themselves in order to function as larger systems in the globe kind of context. But I'll put that aside for now. But I just wanted to raise that. Is this a discovery? Is this a mechanism for discovery of new working models of larger scale norms?
Yes, Stephen.
Yeah, I think that this is a good point, because and discovering that with this model here, where you've got this task specific, and then you've got this effective, actually as a larger sort of scale, time scale sort of check-in, I think it's also relevant in terms of how we can get mechanized in our, like if we just keep doing the same task and we get the reward and the cue, and it starts to create a high sense of this false sense of certainty in our world, which is so much about just constructing more of our social niche and alienating or externalizing the environmental. So we can start to get caught up in this kind of task specific ways of working and silos. And so there may be this could speak to why we need to do some sort of sense breaking to sort of take us out of some of these mechanizations and look at a longer time scale and use affect to do that integration and not just rely on metrics.
Cool. Let's take Scott's point about this being not just an enforcement understanding, but a discovery process, and connect that to some topics we've been considering, like bottom up versus top down function of systems. So the bottom up is learning. That's where the little ants are going out and they're finding different things, or each of the cells in the retina is receiving a different photon, or each person is receiving a different newsfeed. And then as it goes, quote, up or in the system, it's being aggregated. And that is updating progressively more and more summary-like variables, like of teams or of organizations. And then norms can feed back down to lower levels of the system, whether in the brain, like the Bayesian brain or the predictive processing hypothesis, or whether it's team communication norms. And those can be informal or formal. When we are talking about human organizations, we gain this level of syntactic framing of top-down priors. So instead of just saying, this is how things are, like the red blood cells are flowing at this speed, so that's the speed they're flowing at, we're going to say there's a speed limit. And if you don't follow the speed limit, then we're going to have this type of enforcement mechanism. And so it could be the case that in the legal context, that if you just apply a law, a top-down law, it's kind of like trying to teach someone a motor pattern. Let's just say a speech law of some type of controlling speech. It's like controlling someone's motor behavior, again, because it is a motor behavior. And so what would you do? Would you put them in the exoskeleton and say, okay, here's a perfect golf swing. Now you're a golfer, right? Well, no, you actually need to practice and you need to have feedback. And so if the law is overly punitive and it says, oh, that one time that you got put in the exoskeleton, you didn't understand how to golf and other sports that golfers know, how could you not have made the connection there from that one time that I punished you for messing up? That is not an extremely helpful framework for certain issues. So how could we have this bi-directional conversation where there's experimentation and implementation at the edges, and then people's experience percolates upwards in the system, and then the system informally but eventually formally ends up entrenching healthy or productive or agreed upon patterns? So it's an interesting thought about how these type of systems are not just about learning. They're not just about exploitation. As we've been thinking about, they're sort of in both domains and they can trade off. And when they need to exploit, they can dip into exploitative type behavior, but also they can be in an exploratory mode.
We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Stay tuned for next time when we're going to have more discussions of the same paper.